So we're in Matthew's Passion narrative, and the section that we're looking at this morning straddles two distinct phases. It covers the very last bit of the trial phase as Jesus receives from Pilate his capital sentence, and it covers the very first bit of the execution phase as Jesus is handed into the custody of his killers. But despite the fact there's that significant transition in the middle of our passage, I think it still holds together. I don't think our sermon this morning needs to be disjointed because of this crossover from trial to execution. We're going to treat these eight verses in a seamless way, and there are two headings that I invite you to consider. And first of all, then, there's a recurring intensity in Jesus' suffering. There's a recurring intensity in Jesus' suffering. I could say to you this morning that I've been involved in three car crashes. And strictly speaking, that would be true. But if I were then pressed on that claim, I would have to concede that in each case it was the best, lightest, most minimal form of car crash. In each case, I was in a car that was hit from behind by another car that was traveling at a reasonably low speed. Now, in this passage, Jesus experiences rejection, assault, and humiliation. And those experiences, of course, are inherently undesirable, but perhaps in Jesus' case, they are like my car crashes. Perhaps they sound worse than they really were. Perhaps the rejection was just a couple of acquaintances saying, "We're not going to speak to you anymore." And the assault was just a single blow across the face that left him a little bit bruised. And the humiliation was just a well-aimed milkshake dripping down his suit and tie, a la Nigel Farage in Newcastle City Centre last year. Perhaps I'm saying he experienced the best, lightest, most minimal forms of rejection, assault, and humiliation. Perhaps he merely dabbled in those woes. Perhaps in each case, he got off lightly. Well, it requires only a cursory reading of these verses to realize it's not like that at all. To realize that, in fact, it's the opposite. Jesus experienced the worst, heaviest, most maximal forms of rejection, assault, and humiliation. To continue the analogy, these are not scrapes and bumps that barely qualify as car crashes. These are head-on, high-speed smashes. In Jesus' case, the terms rejection, assault, and humiliation fail to do justice to what he experiences, not the other way around. That's what I mean when I say there's this recurring intensity. At each stage of his suffering, he seems to encounter it in its rawest, fiercest, most terrible form. Let's look in more detail. First of all, he experiences rejection of the worst possible kind. I mentioned a moment ago that rejection can be a couple of acquaintances refusing to speak to you. It can be low-level rejection that, provided your skin isn't too paper-thin, is endurable. What Jesus suffers in verse 25 is not that. For one thing, all the people reject him here. That's what Matthew says, all the people. At the very least, that means all the people who are actually present outside the governor's headquarters there in Jerusalem. But interestingly, up until now, Matthew has referred to those actually present as the crowd. Verse 15, verse 20, verse 24. Here, he suddenly shifts to this other term, the people. The people makes you think of a much bigger constituency than those who are lining the streets this Friday morning. It makes you think of the nation, the people of Israel. And I would suggest that's precisely what Matthew wants you to think of. He's saying this crowd speaks here for the people as a whole. Jesus is being rejected by Israel itself. But then for another thing, look at the language they use. His blood be on us. His blood be on us. There's no scapegoating here. There's no dilemma for this crowd. How can we get Jesus executed without it seeming like it's our doing? Their desire to rid the earth of Jesus is too strong for any such considerations to arise. They don't care about evading or even sharing with others, at least, the responsibility. All they care about is getting Jesus on that cross. They're not interested in being subtle and devious. They're not interested in covering their tracks. They're not interested in whitewashing their own involvement in the killing of Jesus. His blood be on us. We're fine with that, they say. It can go down as our deed. It doesn't bother us. Just get him killed, for goodness sake. That's all that matters. This is extreme rejection. But it goes one step further. They say, his blood be on us. And then they add, and on our children. And on our children. I mean, the last thing anyone wants is for their children to share in their guilt. You break the law in some way, and you're caught and punished, and people in the community hear about it. And at school, the other children give your children a hard time about it. And that's the most painful aspect of the whole thing for you. Your poor children haven't done anything wrong. You're the one who has transgressed. Why should they have to suffer? As I say, it's the last thing anyone wants for their children to have to share with them in their guilt. But these people here, they don't say, mind you, Pilate, this is our choice to crucify Jesus. Our children have nothing to do with this. They say, and our children, because they're convinced they're not incurring any guilt, because they're convinced the world would be a better place without Jesus. That's how total this rejection is. Load the responsibility on us, Pilate. Load it on our children too, if you like. That's not a problem. Just get him nailed to that cross. This is devastating, ruthless, brutal stuff. There isn't so much as a shadow of hesitation or misgiving here. They vehemently, passionately, boldly disown Jesus. He experiences rejection of the worst possible kind. Secondly, he experiences assault of the worst possible kind. I said assault can be a single blow across the face. No bones are broken. No hospitalization is required. It's just a bit sore, a bit tender for a while. Assault can be a minor unpleasantness. What Jesus suffers in verse 26 is not that. He's scourged. It's interesting that the ESV doesn't give us an extensive footnote every time it mentions something that's a bit culturally unfamiliar to us. But with this scourging, it does, because the editors know that we will inevitably underestimate this ordeal that Jesus went through. Those of you of a particular generation recall a corporal punishment that took place when you were at school. And something like that, perhaps, is what comes to your mind when you read that Jesus was scourged. And you wince slightly at the remark, but it doesn't make a huge impression on you. And so we need this footnote, because the footnote has it exactly right. A Roman judicial penalty consisting of a severe beating with a multi-lashed whip containing embedded pieces of bone and metal. That's what we're talking about here. We're talking about an obscenely vicious, a shockingly savage pounding of a man's body. The verse makes it sound as though Pilate himself administered the scourging, but of course it doesn't mean that. It means that he authorized it in the same way that he authorized the crucifixion and the burial of Jesus without personally lifting a finger in relation to either event. He didn't pick up the whip and start swinging it around. His squaddies did. Roman soldiers administered the scourging. Spurgeon reflects on the kind of men that these would have been. Men without a streak of pity in them. men utterly desensitized and undilutedly cruel to the very core of their beings. He says cruelty was the element in which they lived. It was worked into their very being. It was their recreation. Their grandest holiday was to go and sit in those tiers of seats at the Colosseum or at some provincial amphitheater and see lions contending with men or wild beasts tearing one another in pieces. And as they lashed Jesus then, if striking a certain part of his body produced a particularly anguished reaction, their instincts wouldn't be to go easy on that part of his body with the next strike. Their instincts would be to press home the advantage, as it were, and hit him there again and again and again. Or if they suddenly discovered a part of his body that they hadn't yet altogether mangled and where his flesh was still recognisably flesh, not just pulp, their instincts wouldn't be to let it go. If that patch of flesh has survived the scourge until now, then fair play to it. Their instincts would be to remedy the omission and lay into that bit of him that they had hitherto missed. That's the kind of men they were. And it isn't just Spurgeon's speculations that tell us that. It's the accounts we have in first century sources outside of the New Testament of these Roman scourges exposing the internal organs of the victims. And indeed sometimes causing men to die and thus removing the need for the subsequent execution. These soldiers, when they got that whip in their hand, they went for it all right. They saw that body tied to the post in front of them as a piece of meat to batter and disfigure and reshape as much as they possibly could. And to be on the receiving end of that then, to be at the center of such an orgy of violence, to be pummeled and torn and minced at the hands of bestial torturers, impervious to any sense of humane restraint, it simply does not bear thinking about. He experiences assault of the worst possible kind. But then he experiences humiliation of the worst possible kind. I said humiliation can be a milkshake thrown at you. That causes you some embarrassment, it affects your dignity, it makes you a laughingstock. Humiliation can be a relatively trivial situation, which even you, the person who experienced it, are able to smile about later on. What Jesus suffers in verses 27 to 31 is not that. The very act of crucifixion was intrinsically humiliating. And on top of that, there would always be a crowd of spectators jeering and taunting at the victim. That was standard. It just came with the territory. What happens to Jesus in verses 27 to 31 is not standard. This did not come with the territory. To be taken off by the soldiers before the crucifixion begins for a private session of mockery, where they, the soldiers, are the mockers, that was exceptional. That was a departure from the norm. One commentator offers this reason why the soldiers went off pieced like this. He says, to have a supposedly self-proclaimed king in their power offered unusually good sport. And for non-Jewish soldiers to have such an opportunity of abusing a Jewish dignity with impunity was not a chance to be missed. The humiliation there in the governor's headquarters has three strands. There's vulgarity. Notice that twice in verse 28 and again in verse 31, Matthew says they stripped him. The verbs are necessary. Matthew could simply say that they put on him a scarlet robe, verse 28. They put on him his own clothes. Verse 31, the verbs are necessary unless Matthew wants us to understand that the stripping wasn't a quick passing thing in order to put a scarlet robe on him, in order to put his own clothes back on him. Rather, it was itself a part of the humiliation. That's the only reason that Matthew would be so specific about this. They stripped him. He's saying the soldiers took great delight in having Jesus stand naked in front of them. We tend to associate Jesus' nakedness with Golgotha itself, don't we? And at least at Golgotha, his denuded state is hidden by darkness for some time. But actually, the place where Matthew emphasizes Jesus' nakedness isn't Golgotha. He implies that Jesus is naked there later on in the narrative, but the place he emphasizes it is here, in the governor's headquarters, where there's no darkness, where Jesus, indecently exposed like this, has nowhere to hide. I'm saying this double stripping of Jesus points to a vulgarity that's part of the humiliation. But as well as vulgarity, there's ridicule. This skit, this piece of theatre. There's a costume involved, the scarlet robe. There are props involved, the crown of thorns and the reed. There's acting involved, the kneeling and the feigned worship. It's all there. And if we're meant to understand the chronological sequence from verse 26 to verses 27 to 31, then there's a whole additional dimension to this scene. The one they are dressing up as a king and bowing before is at that very moment covered in blood, and he's gasping for breath, and his face is contorted with pain because he's just been scourged by the soldiers. And that then makes the ridicule all the more delicious for the soldiers and all the more horrendous for Jesus. But then, as well as vulgarity and ridicule, there's contempt. The way they spit at him and strike him, verse 30. They treat him as something vile and abhorrent and disgusting. And when then the soldiers finally decide that the fun must end, and they begin in verse 31, the journey to the execution site, by then Jesus' dignity isn't just in tatters. It's utterly gone, obliterated by this wretched combination of vulgarity, ridicule, and contempt. He's enveloped in the deeper shame and disgrace. He experiences humiliation of the worst possible kind. So I hope you can see what I mean then about this recurring intensity in Jesus' suffering. He doesn't experience a token dose of this and that and the next thing. He experiences rejection of the worst possible kind, and he experiences assault of the worst possible kind, and he experiences humiliation of the worst possible kind. And the same can be said of all the other components of his suffering beyond those mentioned in these verses. It makes me think of Paul's words that I quoted in a prayer earlier on this morning, there in Romans 8:32. God did not spare his own son. He didn't spare Jesus the worst excesses of Good Friday. He didn't hold back from making Jesus suffer those. No, he unleashed on Jesus the full package. He treated him unsparingly. And it means that you and I can be fully assured this morning that no corners were cut in the accomplishing of our salvation. No one is ever going to be able to put a question mark alongside some aspect of Jesus' suffering. I'm not sure he experienced enough of that. He experienced enough of everything. He experienced every indignity, every terror to the utmost. Everything in its most intense form. Satan himself cannot raise a question mark. Jesus didn't do a budget job, suffering as little as possible to just about pull off a salvation for you and me. No, he threw himself into it and emphatically, unambiguously pulled off a salvation for you and me. It also means that Jesus is never out of his depths when it comes to understanding our sufferings. Remember those great words of Hebrews chapter 4, verse 15, about our high priest at God's right hand being able to sympathize with us. And that's why the writer says we should go to the throne of God when we are struggling, when we are afflicted, because he's there at its right hand. And he will understand and he will ensure that we get the mercy and the grace that we need. And sometimes perhaps we think, but does he really understand? Does he really understand? And I'm saying this morning he does. Because whatever we are suffering, he has suffered it more. He has suffered it to a more intense degree. Are you being rejected this morning? In your family? Rejected by former friends? He has experienced rejection of the worst possible kind. Go to him. He understands. Have you been assaulted physically recently? He has experienced assault of the worst possible kind. Go to him. He understands. Have you been humiliated? Made to feel very ashamed and mortified? He has experienced humiliation of the worst possible kind. Go to him. He understands. There's a lovely couplet in an old hymn by Richard Baxter that's in our hymn book. And it goes like this: Christ leads me through no darker rooms than he went through before. He knows the darkness of your room this morning. He feels for you in that dark room that you're in. He's a welcoming, attentive, comprehending comforter to whom you can go. And so that's the first and the main thing in our passage this morning. There's a recurring intensity in Jesus' suffering. But then secondly, and more briefly, there's a recurring irony in Matthew's storytelling. There's a recurring irony in Matthew's storytelling. The New Testament scholar Don Carson says that in the New Testament, the writers most given to irony are Matthew and John. And I would suggest to you that in this passage then, penned obviously by Matthew, irony abounds. I'm talking about the kind of irony where the words or actions of the characters have a deeper level of meaning than they themselves are aware of. And I think there are three instances of it. First of all, the governor's calculation. The governor's calculation, verse 24. When Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd. When he saw that he was gaining nothing, in an utter surface level then, that means that he saw he was gaining nothing in this business of saving Jesus. Remember, we've seen he's convinced that Jesus is innocent. He wants to let Jesus go, but he sees that while he's tried, as we saw last Sunday morning, his very cleverest tactics to that end, he sees that he's gaining nothing. Jesus is not going to be able to be acquitted. So at the surface level, that's what it means. But I wonder whether there's a deeper level of meaning here. Pilate sees that he is gaining nothing for himself. He's gaining nothing in terms of his own career. This Roman official, who no doubt, like all Roman officials, wants to get as high up the ladder as he possibly can. He sees that this attempt to release Jesus, it's gaining him nothing in those terms. In fact, there's the danger of a riot beginning, which of course would jeopardize his career, because then his bosses higher up the ladder would want to know how he allowed a riot to start on his watch in the streets of Jerusalem. And so he sees that he's gaining nothing for himself. He's gaining nothing career-wise here. The reason I suggest that deeper level of meaning is the word that Matthew uses when Pilate saw he was gaining nothing or profiting nothing. Profiting nothing. It's the word that we've had back in chapter 16, verse 26. What does it profit a man if he gain the world but lose his soul or his very self, depending on how you want to render it? And I would suggest to you then that Matthew wants us to see Pilate here is making the very calculation that Jesus so warns against there. He's putting the world, he's putting his own career, he's putting his own advancement, he's putting his own success before Jesus. He knows Jesus is innocent. He knows Jesus should be acquitted. He knows Jesus should be released and Barabbas nailed to the cross. But he's willing to expend with Jesus when this point comes, when his career now is being jeopardized, a riot is beginning, and he can already hear alarm bells ringing. His senior, his superiors will be after him. And so he puts the world and success and advancement before Jesus. And Matthew wants us to remember Jesus' words and to see that in verse 24, in fact, Pilate is profiting nothing in the deepest possible sense. He's profiting nothing. Because he's expending with the one who is worth everything, Jesus Christ. And I just want to pause then and remind you all that that is something that still many, 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 many people do today. And perhaps some of you in this room are doing. Putting the world before Jesus. Putting success. Putting promotion, putting money, putting prosperity, putting something before Jesus. Pilate, in fact, profited nothing even in a temporal sense, because we know from the history books that not long after this, Pilate was demoted and became a completely forgotten man. But even if Pilate had risen all the way to the position of Roman emperor itself, he would still have been profiting nothing by putting career and success before Jesus. And you might gain much in this world's terms. You might expend with Jesus and you might put your arms around the world and you might gain it all, but a day will come when you will reap what you have sown, and disaster will fall, and you will have profited nothing. Look at Pilate. Remember the warning of chapter 16, verse 26. So there's the governor's calculation. Secondly, there's the crowd's confession. The crowd's confession, we've already talked about this. Verse 25, them crying out, his blood be on us and on our children. And we've said then what they mean by that. And how they are so hostile toward Jesus and so convinced the world needs to be rid of Jesus that they don't mind all the responsibility falling upon them. They don't mind his blood being on them in that sense. But again, I wonder whether there's a deeper meaning here and a happier, deeper meaning this time. Because Matthew is writing several decades after the event, of course. And Matthew knows the subsequent story. He knows what happened in the aftermath of all of this. He knows about Jesus' death and about Jesus' resurrection and about the 40 days after that and about the ascension back into heaven and about that day of Pentecost when the Holy Spirit was poured out by the ascended Jesus on his people. And he knows what happened that day and the way in which Peter, a changed man, suddenly stood up and preached that sermon and accused the crowds of Jerusalem in front of him. You killed Jesus. You, with the help of wicked men, killed Jesus. And he accuses them in that way. And Matthew knows what happened at the end of that sermon and how many of them were convicted of their part in the crucifixion of Jesus. And they cried out in conviction. And Peter was able to tell them to repent and be baptized. And Matthew knows that many of them then joined the Christian church and became disciples of Jesus. And perhaps then, Matthew wants us to understand the double meaning when they cry, "His blood be on us." What they mean on that day was, "We're happy to be responsible for Jesus' death." But ultimately, Jesus' blood did come on some of those people in a different sense. In the sense that Jesus has talked about back in chapter 26 and verse 28. "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins." Some of them had his blood poured on them in that forgiving, sin atoning, sin cleansing sense. What a wonderful thing that is. I mean, if you've been there that day in Jerusalem watching them and seen the vehemence of that crowd, you would never have imagined that the ones crying out, "His blood be on us," would one day celebrate his blood being on them to cleanse them of their sins. And should that not give us some hope as we think of some people that we know this morning? Those who just so casually blurt out Jesus Christ every other paragraph. Those people could one day be crying Jesus Christ in worship and adoration. Those who say, "God help us," meaning absolutely nothing by that, could one day cry out, "God help us," seriously, meaning every word of it. Because that transformation can happen. If it could happen to these people, it can happen to any people. Let's not give up hope, but be hopeful and expectant as we continue to witness to the saving Jesus Christ. The governor's calculation, the crowd's confession, and then one more thing, the soldier's coronation. The soldier's coronation. Because there's irony there as well, isn't there? In verse 29, the irony there is utterly straightforward. The one to whom they're saying, "Hail, King," is indeed the King. He is indeed the King. They are speaking more than they know. They think they're being hilarious. They're actually speaking the truth. Even the way they do it, the props they use, the crown of thorns. Is there not perhaps some deep truth in that? Is it not perhaps reminding those with eyes to see what sort of king this is? Who is this king? What kind of king are we talking about? Well, you look at the crown on his head. It's a crown of thorns. And what does that remind us of? Or does it not remind us of Genesis chapter 3, thorns? The great expression of the curse that came on the earth that day. We could almost say, couldn't we, that King Adam, remember how Adam was crowned in Genesis 1 as the king of the creation, rule over it, God said to him. Could we not almost say that in Genesis 3, Adam shuffles shamefully out of that garden, his crown having been taken away and replaced with a crown of thorns? And here Jesus comes, and Jesus is the new Adam to undo the work of the first, And so he puts on that crown of thorns that Adam had to shamefully wear as he shuffled out of the garden, in order that he might regain for many of Adam's race the true crown. He's not just some minor king come to address a minor problem. He's come to address the world's greatest problem. He's a new Adam, come to undo and replay the work of the first. And if then this morning we know him as that king, let's take our cue from these soldiers and cry, "Hail, Jesus, our King." Spurgeon, to mention him once more as I close, he has a whole sermon on just the expression in verse 27, "They gathered the whole battalion." He points out that Mark also tells us that detail. It wasn't just some of the battalion, it was the whole battalion that came out to mock Jesus. Let me close quoting Spurgeon's words on this. He says, "When Jesus was to be mocked, all the soldiers came up. Some of them were down in the canteen, but they left their wine and came up to mock him. Some of the soldiery perhaps had furlough for that day, but they gave up their holiday to go to mock Christ. Now then, brethren and sisters, if his enemies could gather together the whole band against him, let us gather together the whole band for him. Why, just look at some of you on the Lord's day. There are a few drops of rain that might spoil your best bonnets or wet your new clothes, so you cannot go to chapel. You'd have gone to market, you know, rain or shine. How many there are who will not be able to come at the prayer meeting this week? One pleaded some time ago at the prayer meeting, 'Lord, bless those that are at home on beds of sickness.' 'Yes,' said the preacher, 'and Lord, bless those that are at home on sofas of wellness.' There are plenty of that kind who stay at home because they have not enough of the hearty spirit that ought to be in them to let the whole band gather together to confess Christ. Do you love Jesus Christ, my dear sister? Then come and confess it. Do you love Jesus Christ, my brother? Then out with your avowal of it." May we be those who wholeheartedly cry, "Jesus, our King." Amen.